Vasiu Vasiha Dabaro, which means the clay pot. The clay pot is an important feature in the burial services of the peoples of the native peoples of South America. What they do is, when a person dies, they construct a large, fresh clay pot, and they bury the person, he or she, in the pot. And the words to the song, which we won't sing, is, I want to be buried like my ancestors in the womb of the clay pot. When the curtain is drawn to end my life, I will live in your memory. Your memory of me will always be as fresh as the fresh clay pot I was buried in. See how the bottle.
Under the sun, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to laugh and a time to mourn. This is the time we gather to remember someone who gave meaning to our lives. This is the time to recall the bonds that hold us, the love we shared, the memories that sustained us.
We'll have a minute of silent meditation. The name of this story is Nadia the Willful. It was written by Sue Alexander. Do you know what willful means, Ruben? A lot of will and strength and to go forward. And it also means wanting your own way. And sometimes it can be a weakness, sometimes a strength. In the land of the drifting sands, there lived a girl whose stubbornness and flashing temper caused her to be known throughout the desert as Nadia the Willful. Nadia's father, the Sheikh Tariq, did not know what to do with his willful daughter. Only Hamid, the eldest of Nadia's six brothers, could calm Nadia's temper when it flashed. "Oh, angry one," he would say, "shall we see how long you can stay that way?" And then he would laugh and tease and pull at her dark hair until she would laugh too. And she would follow Hamid wherever he led. One day before dawn, Hamid mounted his father's great white stallion and rode to the west to seek new grazing ground for the sheep. Hamid did not return. Nadia rode behind her father as he traveled across the desert from oasis to oasis, seeking Hamid. Shepherds told them of seeing a great white stallion fleeing before the pillars of sand, stirred by the wind. And they said that the horse carried no rider. At last, Tariq knew in his heart that his son had been claimed by the drifting sands, and he told Nadia what he knew, that Hamid was dead. Nadia screamed and wept and stamped the sands, crying, "Not even Allah will take Hamid from me," until her father could bear no more and he bade her to silence. Nadia's grief knew no bounds. She walked blindly through the oasis, neither seeing nor hearing those who would console her. And Tariq was silent. He stayed in his tent for days, eating little and saying nothing at all. On the seventh day, Tariq came out of his tent. He called all of his people to him and spoke, "From this day forward, let no one utter Hamid's name. Punishment shall be swift for those who would remind me of what I have lost." Nadia did as her father decreed, although each day held something to remind her of Hamid. Each memory brought Hamid's name to Nadia's lips, but she stilled the sound. And each time that she did so, her unhappiness grew, until finally she could no longer contain it. She wept and raged at anyone and anything that crossed her path. Soon everyone in the oasis fled at her approach, and she was more lonely than she had ever been before. One day, as Nadia passed the place where her brothers were playing, she stopped to watch them. Without thinking, she called out to them, "That is not the way. Hamid said that first you jump this way and then you jump back." Her brothers stopped their game and looked around in fear. Had Tariq heard Nadia say Hamid's name? But the Sheikh was nowhere to be seen. "Teach us, Nadia, as our brother taught you," asked her smallest brother. And so she did. Then she told them of other games and how Hamid had taught her to play them. And as she spoke of Hamid, she felt an easing of the hurt within her heart. And so she went on speaking of Hamid. She went to where the women sat at their looms and told them stories Hamid had told her, and she made them laugh as Hamid had made her laugh. "Remember your father's promise of punishment," Nadia's mother warned when she heard Nadia speaking of Hamid. "Cease, I implore you." But Nadia did not know how to tell her mother that speaking of Hamid eased the pain she felt. And so she said only, "I will speak my brother's name, I will." And she ran away from the sound of her mother's voice. She went to where the shepherds tended the flock, and she spoke of Hamid. And soon they were telling her tales that they knew of Hamid and his little black lamb. The more Nadia spoke of Hamid, the clearer his face became in her mind. She could see his smile and the light in his eyes. She could hear his voice. And the clearer Hamid's voice and face became, the less Nadia heard inside and the less her temper flashed. At last, she was filled with peace. But her mother was still afraid for her willful daughter. One day, the youngest shepherd came to Nadia's tent, calling, "Come, Nadia, see Hamid's black lamb? It has grown so big and strong." But it was not Nadia who came out of the tent. It was Tariq. On the sheikh's face was a look more fierce than that of a desert hawk, and when he spoke, his words were as sharp as a scimitar. "I have forbidden my son's name to be said, and I promised punishment to whoever disobeyed my command. So shall it be. Be gone from this oasis." "No," cried Nadia, hearing her father's words. "I have spoken," roared the sheikh. "It shall be done." In the hours that followed, fear made everyone turn away from Nadia as she tried to tell them of Hamid and the things he had done and said. And the less she was listened to, the less she was able to recall Hamid's face and voice. And the less she recalled, the more her temper raged within her, destroying the peace she had found. By evening, she could stand it no longer. She went to where her father sat alone in the desert, and she stood before him. "Can you recall Hamid's face?" she asked him. "Can you still hear his voice?" And Tariq started in surprise. "No, I cannot. Day after day I have sat in the spot where I last saw Hamid, trying to remember the look, the sound, the happiness that was my beloved son. But I cannot." And he wept. Nadia's voice became gentle. "There is a way, honored father," she said. "Listen." And she began to speak of Hamid. She told of walks she and Hamid had taken, of talks they had had. She told many things that she remembered, some happy and some sad. And when she was done with the telling, she said gently, "Can you not recall him now, father? Can you not see his face? Can you not hear his voice?" Tariq nodded through his tears, and for the first time since Hamid's death, he smiled. "So you see, father," and this time Nadia's voice was gentler than the softest of the desert breezes, "there is a way Hamid can be with us still." For a long time, Tariq pondered. And after a long time, he spoke, and the sharpness was gone from his voice. "Tell my people to come before me, Nadia," he said. "I have something to say to them." And when they were all assembled, Tariq said, "From this day forward, let my daughter Nadia be known not as willful, but as wise. And let her name be praised in every tent, for she has returned to me my beloved son." And so it was. The shepherd returned to his flock. Kindness and graciousness returned to the oasis, and Nadia's name was praised in every tent. And Hamid lived again in the hearts of all who remembered him.
Actually, because of all the participation and in interest of time, we will skip the joys and sorrows and just go on to greeting your neighbor, people beside you.
Okay. will have hymn number 315, This Old World. Inspiration for this year's All Souls services comes from a few lines of Shakespeare's Macbeth. It's, "Give sorrow words. The grief that does not speak whispers the o'er-fraught heart and bids it break." Give sorrow words. I've been struck by the efforts of the New York Times to give expression to the grief that relatives experienced after the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center. And as you may know, every day in the New York Times there's a full page with portraits and a few paragraphs after each one of the victims. They do about 15 per page. And they have a project of trying to cover all of the victims, over 5,000. So it will take about a year or so to complete this. And here is just one of these sketches. Is it Alice Alonzo? Janet Alonzo, pardon. Okay. Mm-hmm. Janet Alonzo. The next to last phone call Janet Alonzo made on the morning of September 11th was typical. Its genesis was maternal anxiety, and its focal point was her second child, Robbie, born with Down syndrome 18 months ago. She was not only checking in with her mother-in-law, Margaret Alonzo, who handled the babysitting during the 3 days each week that Janet spent as an email analyst for Marsh and McLennan. She was also making sure Robbie's foot braces, misplaced on Monday, had been located and returned to him. He finds it impossible to take his baby steps without them. "Check his stroller," Janet suggested. Bingo, Grandma discovered the braces. Though her children were her passion, Janet was a diligent homemaker, literally. She loved painting and refinishing furniture and spent the weekend before the disaster sanding the porch they had added to their house in Stony Point, New York. Her final call was to her husband. She told him that the office was filling with smoke and that she could not breathe. And she told him that she loved him.
I
I'd like to light the large candle here for all those victims of September 11th and also for the victims in Afghanistan. Give sorrow words. I actually did not know of these words before. I found them in a book called In the Midst of Winter, Selections from the Literature of Mourning, and edited by Mary Jane Moffat. And this collection grew out of her own need for such a resource when her marriage ended by the sudden death of her husband. Mary Jane Moffat writes in her introduction, Linda, to In the Midst of Winter.
We live in a culture poor in meaningful rite or ceremony. My husband's simple memorial service was consistent with what my sons and I thought would have been his wishes, but it did not persuade me that he was truly dead or that a passage of such significance to me had been sufficiently honored. Outwardly, I appeared to be managing well, continuing my teaching, settling financial matters, trying to take care of the emotional needs of those who wanted to care for me. I was, in short, performing the role the outer world admires of one who is taking it very well. But this facade is an exact contradiction to what psychologists say is necessary to complete successfully the task of mourning, in which all aspects of the loss must be expressed and worked through. Grief repressed, we're told, will exact a price, often years later.
Moffat also writes that she found solace for the first time in literature, in prose and poetry, which uses metaphors from the objective world that corresponded to her own inner life. For example, she writes that the use of winter and summer in these lines by Albert Camus gave her her first bit of comfort. Here are the lines. In the midst of winter, I finally learned that there was in me an invincible summer. These lines somehow did not try to comfort or explain. They merely described her own emotion, and in that, she felt confirmation, she felt a catharsis. So this book is organized into the various seasons of grief and ends with a section on grief's wisdom and acquiescence. Well, this is our fourth annual All Souls Day service, and these were inspired by a trip that I took many years ago to Michoacan, Mexico for the Day of the Dead. And many of you may know that this is a three-day festival in Mexico, and it involves family altars, visiting, it involves fireworks, parades, all sorts of good food, and it's a celebration and remembrance of the dead. At a time set aside, 3 days of it. Our son Tom is also a devotee of the Day of the Dead and recently went to Mexico and came back with a few of these mementos here. And you see a lot of humor in them. Here is a mariachi fellow holding, in one case, an instrument, and the other, some tequila. and then they have these little dioramas. Some of them are a little racy. The dead have a lot of fun. There's a lot of mocking humor in Mexico. And but the culminating event for me was in the cemetery, which takes place on the last day of the festival. I want you to close your eyes and picture this scene. You're in a small rural cemetery in Mexico at 10 o'clock at night on November 2nd. You expected darkness,
but the cemetery's ablaze with light, simply the light of candles. On every grave there are dozens of large candles which will burn all night long. The smell of wax mingles with the incense of the burning of copal. Another surprise. In the U.S., the cemetery is a solitary place, but this one is teeming with people and the atmosphere is festive. Families are sitting in groups huddled around their relatives' graves. People are talking together, passing food, drinking, laughing. Others are tearful. Babies are passed from lap to lap. We learned that most of these people will stay here all night, remembering, sharing stories, keeping the dead company. Well, this scene is such a contrast to the North American customs where grief is often hidden and private, and remembrance of the dead is sporadic and without ritual. In Mexico, you can grieve in public, feeling the support of the entire community, and the dead are not forgotten but remembered and celebrated at a time set aside each year. Well, I came back wanting to share the essence of this with Prairie, and I felt sure we could adapt a kind of a simple service that would suit our own needs. And at that time, I didn't know if there were any other congregations doing this or not. Then I discovered this issue of the UU World, July-August 2000, and in it is an article by a minister from Davis, California, Peter Morales. He has a Mexican background, and he started such services in his congregation. And Peter will read what he writes. The idea? The idea is not to mimic? The idea, Peter.
The idea is not to mimic the Mexican tradition, but to draw from its wisdom. Traditional cultures, with their mediums and ghosts and reincarnation, have understood something we repress. The dead don't die. They live on. I'm not speaking metaphysically or theologically. I'm talking about the very real stuff of memory, history, look in the mirror. The DNA of your ancestors is alive in you. Your children, yourself, and your ancestors. Think of the decisions made by your parents and grandparents. Their choices shape your life. And the choices we make every day shape the lives of those to come.
And Peter Morales also describes what these services have meant to him and his congregation. It's a fourth reading.
Accepting the day of the dead ceremony, which was how the commentary accepted my view of Pinsbury University and my own sense of mystery, I now see there is a depth, feeling, and passion just below the surface among us. We're united not just by abstract principles and lofty ideals, but by memories, personal loss, and shared history. What is more, because the larger culture designs the reality of death and has little sense of history, today remembering our dead can be profoundly related. When we allow ourselves to feel our place along the continuum of life and death, it will be sweet.
Well, we invite you now to come up and to speak briefly about someone that you have lost, and you can place any article or photographs that you brought on the tables and then light a candle. Or maybe you'd just like to light a candle in silence for someone.
First one is to light a match.
Candle.
I brought a picture of my father, Rollin Mapes Chatterton. He was a photographer, and this is a self-portrait that he did in the early 50s. My father was very serious in many ways, but he had a very light side and a kind of odd sense of humor. I have kept this faucet, which reminds me of him, because he used to draw cartoons with the old-fashioned paper faucet coming out of the back of someone's head. And there would be drips coming out of it, and he would label them blood, grease, hair oil, things like that. And so I look at this, and I always think about him and laugh. He also told short little funny stories. He had a very unusual sense of humor. Something that would really crack him up would be something like this. Barney Smoot slipped on a banana peel and fell into a barrel full of pig tripe and suffocated. That's some of my heritage.
In August, our whole family happened to be out east, largely because I bought everybody Lion King tickets, and they managed to make the scene. And we had a wonderful visit with my great aunt, who had never had children of her own, and who was a good 8 or 9 years younger than my grandmother. So she was sort of more like an aunt than a great aunt, and had been very doting on us in our childhood. And I was really thrilled that Katrina and Eric got to know her a little bit also. About 6 days after our wonderful visit with her, she died very unexpectedly, very suddenly, which was undoubtedly the way she would have wanted to go. We flew out east, Katrina and I, for the funeral, and it was exactly 1 week before September 11th. So we were grateful that we got to mourn her in singularity and not amid the grief that washed over the world the following week. One of the things that I inherited is this picture of her first grade class. And she and I went to the same school.
Oh.
That was the wonderful thing about growing up in the hometown of your mother and your grandmother and your great-grandmother. She's number 29, but what I love about this picture is how integrated the class is. I mean, there are all kinds of different colors of children in this picture, which is really neat. And I'm going to miss her.
I'd like to remember an old professor of mine. His name was Joseph Dressler. Joseph Dressler was the chairman of the phys ed department at Trent College, and I'm very fond of his students. He's also the coach of the gymnastic team, and I was a member of the team. As a matter of fact, he admired my ability so much he even recommended me to be a member of the staff of the phys ed department. Unfortunately, in technicality, I didn't have a degree in phys ed, but history barred me from I made many, many professors and teachers, supervisors whom I admired, but none as much as Joe Dressler. During the McCarthy days, because he was a leftist, he wound up in California, got a job as a foreman in a factory. When Ruth and I would visit her brothers in Southern California, we always made it a point to drop in and visit with Dr. Dressler and his wife. And here's a picture of the two of us. I guess you can guess maybe who is Dressler. One thing he once said, you know, has always left an impression on me. He was about 5 years older than me, and he had surgery, and he was in a rather weakened position. He was this energetic, this formerly vibrant gymnastic champion, and what he told me was, when everybody else runs, everyone walks, he stands. When everyone stands, he sits. And when everyone sits, he lies down. It came as a shock, but now I experience the So here's a wonderful guy, Joe Dressler, who died a few years ago.
out and walk down to the temple.
My mother's sister Beulah was the hairdresser in the family, and one of our Southwest relatives said she sure did dig the adobe. And we lost her, I guess a little over a year ago. She was also the only member of the family who had raised a son by herself, and having done so myself, it was nice having one member of the family who knew in her gut what my experiences were. And so for that, I miss her a whole lot. Aunt Beulah was a marvelous handy worker. She did, I have some needlepoint up on my wall. I have a quilt on the bed, a beautiful quilt that she made. And everybody in the family has something that Aunt Beulah made. When my son graduated from high school, she gave him what was to us a rather peculiar present. And I get this present out once a year. And you'll know why I get it out once a year. It ends up in front of a parade on Regent Street once a year. And it's going to end up on display in a knitting store pretty soon. By the way, I'll leave pictures of my Aunt Beulah as an adult and as a little girl. My mother's also here, but Beulah's the blonde in this picture. And this is something I'm rather ambivalent about, and maybe this is a good time to bring it out.
Child 12 years ago. His name was John, and he just had a 40th birthday in June, so we celebrated it tonight. And toasted him. One of the things about losing a, he wasn't a baby when he died, he was 28, but one of the things about losing a child is that you're not just cheated of his presence, you're cheated of his future. You always want to see how your kids are going to be. And kids that grew up, when ours grew up, grew up in a very turmoil generation, and shall we say that they did not always reconcile well with or early with their parents. And you always hope for that to happen somewhere along the line. Sometimes it didn't happen until they married and had children of their own. But we didn't get to see that with John. A cousin sent me this. John's 5 years old in here. And the cousin was married. She's a Baptist married to a Jew, so they sort of had to continue their service. And they headed outdoors at a country inn. And as always, the wedding cake was tiered, and you know the first layer is cut and the cardboard's removed, and the next layer is cut. I can't support them without the cardboard. And John, from under his blonde bangs with his big brown eyes up this high, walked over to the man after the first layer was gone and said, "What are you going to do with all that walking? It was, you know, for a kid, the perfect moment. And so, you know, I remember lots of things about him. Some were wonderful and some were not too hot. But on this particular day at age 5, things were great. So this is John Gardner Dorney, age 40 and a little bit. And I will light a candle just for him. Dear to me is my son, but who were dear to me, and more than that, they mattered a lot to other people. The three who made a difference, I guess. I'm sure at least one of them will be mentioned again. One of them is David Ryan, who died very early this year on Jesus' death here. And David very typically did not leave a will, and he had good sides of faith. And the first sentence here says, the class, he was a hellraiser. But I was very glad to have been his friend. And speaking of hellraisers and iconoclasts, this one belongs to us. This is Shirley Oakland and Durkin. And this is the article. I don't know if you've all seen it. The day that we had the service for her, the Milwaukee Journal also did a piece on her. We had called Bob and asked about it because she was a Milwaukee native and she was known for the things she did for social advocacy well outside of men. So this says things that maybe you didn't all read in her obituary. Yes, including the first line. They said she died peacefully Wednesday after, according to her death notes, a long and courageous battle with the authorities. I think it's fitting that Shirley and Babe lie on this table together. The third person, I don't know how many of you knew him, I don't know if George did, is a man called Larry Giles. Larry had a very obscure sort of leukemia that he diagnosed himself. He was a doctor, and they had a heck of a time finding out what it was. He figured out what it was. I met him in class about 5 years ago in his 70s, and with a death sentence hanging over his head. A published poet, a pilot, a deep sea diver, you name it, he did it. And competent about 6 languages and slightly less than competent in about 4 more. A brilliant, eclectic man. And I was very pleased to have known him, and he was very helpful to me because he helped her progress the things to me as well. And he is what helped me encourage to go back. So, this is Larry. These are three people that have made a lot of difference to me. I feel in many ways very humbled in their presence and very.
Moments with all the kids had arrived and had a few
looking to the front of my father is sitting up, partly, and he's watching. And all of a sudden he says, "Look at that, world famous cardiologist, and he can't even turn on the wire." <He's dying. laughs> So is it. They're still around. Still listening. Even so far. Thank you very much. Yes, it was. Matter of fact, the headman and the cardiologist told us that he taught the people on the floor more about dying than anyone did. Thank you.
Thank you.
As is our custom, we'll be reading the names of prairie members who have died, and Mary Mullen, I believe, was going to do that for us. And Linda, I think we do have enough candles. You could light one for each one. Okay, for Rand Cotley. For Roland Parrish. For Avis Parrish. For Bill Caldwell. For Rebecca Clark. For Betsy Roberts. For Lois Hagstrom. For John Dorney. For Les Lyons. For Dorothy Weatherby. For Marv Werpel. For Carol Dopp. For John Grindrod. For Mike Sheehy. For Sydney Mannering. For Judy Perlman. For Odell Taliaferro. For Hazel Taliaferro. For Henry Pratt. For Paula Elkins. For David Carson. And for Shirley Grindrod.
Thank you all very much for your contribution. And now we'll be singing hymn number 18. Wonderful early American melody.
Oh my soul, what wondrous love.
ahead the offering.
The guests and visitors can be introduced or can introduce themselves if you wish.
Some of you may not know our son Tom here, who is going to go off to work shortly.
Now we can have time for brief prayer announcements.
Thank you.
Our closing words will be a responsive reading, 646. We clasp the hands of those that go before us. We enter the little circle of each other's arms. And the larger circle of all creatures. To a music so subtle and vast that no ear hears it. Thank you for your fragments. And please do come up and take a look at all the pictures and objects here on the table. And I want to tell you, our La Muerte here on the wall is a present from Tom last Christmas. He had gone to El Dia de los Muertos celebrations. So please, yes.
Okay, thank you. Happy to come.
Thank you. Join us.